More action.
More action.
More updates.
More updates.
The news you need now.
You need it now.
MRAP. Breaking news.
We're gonna break it.
There's really only one thing to discuss as far as breaking news, and that obviously is the coronavirus COVID-19. On Wednesday night, Mel had a chat with Dave Tallon, who's an EMIM ID doc at a UCLA, about COVID-19, and there's a lot of great information in there. The full video is posted on YouTube as well as on MRAP in case you missed it that night. It's free, open access, and I highly recommend checking it out. I'm going to mention a couple of things that they chatted about, and then we're going to get into a bit on airway management with none other than Scott Weingart. The big news on Wednesday was that the WHO classified COVID-19 as a pandemic. We all knew this was already happening, but now it is confirmed by the WHO. Dave also mentioned some projections from Johns Hopkins as well as Anthony Fauci from the CDC, estimating that 50% of Americans will become infected with this virus. With a 1% mortality rate, we're talking about 3 million people who are going to die from this. And that is 10 times the rate that we see in seasonal flu. So obviously this is a serious public health threat. Dave talked about converting our approach to this from containment to mitigation. Containment is over, and what we need to do is try to flatten the curve. This is something that you'll see on all of the different social media, all the different regular media outlets talking about flattening the curve, and this is slowing the rate of progression of disease so that we are not hit with 10 million cases in the next week or two, but instead those 10 million cases are going to be spread out over time. That obviously buys us time to figure out some treatment modalities, possibly in the development of a vaccine, although Dave says the vaccine is 10 to 12 months away, maybe 12 to 18 months away, nothing we're going to see anytime soon. More importantly, it allows us to not have a huge stress on our healthcare system, which is already pretty stressed to begin with. If we're seeing that many patients in that short a period of time, we're going to obviously overwhelm the systems that we have. Right now, the recommendations for trying to flatten that curve aren't much different than they were before. Good hand hygiene, don't touch your face, social distancing, unnecessary travel should be canceled, and I think most medical conferences probably shouldn't be happening at this point. And I think Dave echoes the same thing. Putting that many providers in the same place is not just a breeding ground for transmission, but also could take out a significant portion of our workforce in one fell swoop. So we need to be really careful about thinking about, are these conferences really necessary? I know many training programs have moved their conferences to the virtual realm, so we're using things like Zoom, et cetera, to do teleconferencing and get the information to people, but not bring all those people together when we don't have to. A lot of what Dave and Mel did was answer questions from the audience. We had a really great audience sending in questions for that live stream. One was about the test characteristics of the PCR test. The sensitivity of these tests is only around 75%. The specificity is thought to be pretty good. So that means that a negative test doesn't mean that the patient doesn't have COVID-19. They might actually need retesting. They might still need to be quarantined at home, even if they have a negative test. The risk of co-infection, so having another virus and also having COVID-19, is low. It's not 0%. It's probably somewhere around or maybe just under 2%. But again, we don't have great information on that. In general, we are saying that if you get a respiratory virus panel or an influenza panel and those are positive, that COVID-19 is most likely ruled out, although it is not impossible to have both of these. Another thing that came up a bunch of times on the live stream was the use of imaging, specifically CT scan. This is not a good screening test. There are going to be patients who are going to have symptoms, who are going to have negative CT scans. In addition to that, remember that every time you run someone through the CT scanner, you're going to have to disinfect before somebody else can use that CT scanner. So we should not be using CT scans for screening at this point. It might be helpful in the sickest subset of patients, otherwise not much utility. There was a lot of talk around triage and what might be the ideal way to do this. Some of the things that came out of the talk with Dave, I think, that are important is that the ideal might be outside. I know a lot of places are doing their screening outside because open air might be better, air circulation is better, sun and warmth may kill the virus. That might just be wishful thinking, but in general, we should be moving these processes outside when possible. And the triage nurse, the person who is in triage screening all these patients, should have full PPE. Dave suggests airborne precautions for that person because they are at such a high risk interacting with so many different people. Now, airborne precautions means N95, face shield, gown, gloves. That's what the triage nurse should have on. Donning that PPE and doffing that PPE is really important. We know from prior outbreaks, things like when we had Ebola going around and SARS and MERS, one of the problems was in doffing that we were breaking containment. So we need to make sure that we're doing this properly. And the ideal is to have a two-person system with a spotter telling the person when they have broken that containment so that they can properly doff. And I think that's what we need to be instituting in our emergency departments. There were a lot of questions around PPE and the isolation rooms that we're using. One that came up a number of times was, what if we don't have a negative pressure isolation room ready for that patient? And this is going to be a problem because most of our emergency departments have a small number of those rooms, one, maybe a couple. And so what do we do when we run out of those rooms? What Dave recommended is putting the patient in a private room and full PPE every time you go in. When that patient leaves that room, there needs to be one of those terminal cleans. And of course, the person cleaning that room also needs to be in full PPE when they go in there. These are tricky situations, but this is probably the best that we have when we don't have an unlimited number of negative pressure rooms. The other question that came up along logistics was the N95 mask and how often they need to be replaced. And nobody's 100% sure, but most people say that this is going to be okay for an 8-hour shift. You can use the same mask for 1 8-hour shift, and then you probably shouldn't use it anymore. If it gets wet, it is now useless and you're going to have to replace it. And really carefully thinking about the PPE and the negative isolation rooms is important because we know from the Hong Kong experience, this is something Dave shared with us on the live stream, healthcare workers who donned and doffed appropriately had a 0% transmission rate. So when we enforce those rules, there's a good outcome. So we need to be sticking with that. Now, things might change. We know that in a week or two, we might have different recommendations on what's the best PPE. We might be stepping down our recommendations, might be stepping up our recommendations, and we will get you that information as it comes out. Again, for all of the information that Mel and Dave spoke about, you can pop over to YouTube. If you search MRAP COVID-19, it will come up. You can go to the MRAP site. It is going to be right at the top of the live and MRAP HD segments. It'll be right there for you. That'll give you the full discussion. Use this for education in your hospital. Use it for education of your residents. Use it any way you want. This is free, open access. We think it's really important to get this information to everybody. So please access that. Take a look at it. And I'm sure that Mel and Dave will do another one of these down the line when we think it's necessary or when you tell us that it's necessary for an update. Scott, let's get into some more practical matters. We have discussed a lot about the epidemiology of COVID-19, the symptoms that patients are going to have, how we should be screening. But one of the things that has come across our desk in emails, in letters, faxes, if anyone's still faxing out there, is how to safely intubate these patients. A lot of the emergency providers are anticipating the fact that these patients are going to show up, they're going to get sick, and we're going to have to intubate them, and we want to have the safest approach. So Scott, I want to go through this and give a little bit of a breaking news segment on how best to approach the airway. You good with that?
Yeah, it sounds right, with the proviso that none of this is evidence-based. This is just the best I could do and the best ideas I have for how we're going to actually do it in our unit.
I think that's great. I think that's one of the big problems is no one really does have enough firsthand experience and there's not much published out there. The start of this really has to be, what's so special about COVID-19 as opposed to the other infectious airways that we deal with?
Probably nothing. The fear is, A, we don't know as much about this particular virus as we do about others. And then it's the lethality that really worries people. And since we are in a state of real ignorance about how exactly the spread is going to happen, and since we are far more fearful, then we have a higher level of need for security, I think is what it comes down to.
When you look at the epidemiology of the disease, it seems that young, healthy people are getting some mild cold-like symptoms. The recovery rate's very high. The mortality rate is extremely low. Scott, I'm pretty healthy. Most emergency clinicians are on the healthier, younger side. So why modify my approach when the worst case scenario seems to be a little sniffly nose and cough?
Yeah, I think that might be underestimating the situation. We don't have ideal epidemiologic data, as you've alluded to in other segments. But what we do know is that this is a higher mortality than most of the things we have dealt with thus far. And it does affect people without comorbidities, obviously at a much lower rate. But the most current data I saw was somewhere around, 0.6 to 0.9% of young patients without comorbidities in terms of case lethality for patients who are hospitalized. Well, that's still not great. I mean, it's not bad odds, but it's certainly not good odds either.
We talked quite a bit with Isaac Bogosh about PPE, surgical mask, face shield, disposable gown, and gloves for most clinical contact. How does the PPE differ if we're intubating?
The idea is we're going to pretend or assume that there can be aerosolized particles, either in the case of a patient who's coughing so much that they need airway protection or just from all the maneuvers we do during airway management. So as such, we're not going to go with the droplet precaution we might do on a flu patient. We're going to go with the best possible protection we're going to get short of going on full, you know, self-contained breathing apparatus, level one Ebola intubation. So at our shop, what we're going to be doing is a N95 mask, or if you're bearded or you've decided at your hospital to go with the alternative of a PAPR system, you know, something that is a fully contained hood linked to a HEPA filter, one of those two. If you are wearing an N95 mask, a surgical mask over it, just so there is one additional layer that could be stripped off in case there's any contamination. Some form of eye and face protection that is more than just the surgical masks with something attached to them, such that there's a space between that visor and your forehead. That's less desirable. So something that's either a hood or a full face shield that leaves less path for aerosolized particles to get in. So it's not just protecting the front of your face, it's really containing your eyes. A bunny suit, which I don't know, that's just the vernacular at our place for something that really covers you from ankles to neck, or preferably ankles into a hood such that it covers and just leaves your face exposed, and the face will be blocked by what other secondary device we just mentioned. If you can't get a hooded suit, then some form of, you know, surgical sterile disposable cap. And then probably two pairs of gloves, one underneath the gown and then one you put on above, with long cuffs if you got them. This is the best I could come up with, Swami. How does this differ from what you folks are doing?
I think this is probably the ideal approach. You're right. A PAPR is probably unnecessary. It's really hard to maneuver in those and actually do any kind of procedure. The bunny suits, I don't know if there's a better term for those. It conjures up in my mind the little kid in A Christmas Story. That's what they look like. And that's why they're called bunny suits, as far as I'm concerned. We don't always have those. And personal protection equipment is becoming a little bit of a scarce commodity. And we need to be careful with those. But we're also not intubating a ton of these patients. And so we need to take as much precaution as possible. I'm seeing people in these situations also just grabbing those disposable gowns like we use in trauma situations, which clearly are not going to be as protective. So I would love to have something that covers my entire body, covers my hair. If you don't have those bunny suit, I agree, at least like the little surgical cap, at least it's something there. There's not a ton out there. It seems there are a fair number of reports of COVID-19 patients developing ARDS. And we talked about vent management and ARDS with Haney last week. It seems responsible to think that hypoxia is going to be a major factor for these patients prior to intubation. What modifications should we be making to our pre-ox strategy, and what should be our preferred strategy?
What is currently recommended out there, Swami, is non-rebreather, no non-invasive, no high flow. And I disagree with some of those recommendations. So let's walk through it step by step. A non-rebreather mask, it delivers crap FiO2 at the normal settings, you know, the 15 liters we normally put these patients on. If you want the patient to get good pre-oxygenation, it has to be at flush rate. But I'm concerned about that because now we're putting high flows directly against the patient's exhalations. And I don't know what that does to the exhalations. And since these are devices open to the environment, it doesn't seem a great way to go. It's probably better than something like high flow nasal cannula, which I just don't think we should be using at all. But there is a better option, I think. And it's basically two options, but they basically rely on the same thing, which is if you have non-invasive masks that do not vent to the environment. And I guess we have to go on a little tangent to explain what this really encompasses. There's two forms of BiPAP systems you're going to deal with in your hospitals. There's the kind where there's one tube sticking out of a machine that puts the inhalation towards the patient, and then their exhalation is passive. It's to the environment. There's a hole in the mask stem that actually vents all their exhaled gas to the environment. Those seem horrible to me. And if that's the only thing you have available in your emergency department, I would just ignore using non-invasive. But if you could get a mask that has a port that is not vented, these are designed to be used with ventilators for non-invasive. Two tube systems where the inhalation comes up one tube and the exhalation goes down another. Just the availability of those masks give you a couple of options that I think are better than the non-rebreather. Option one is you take that non-invasive mask and you attach it to a BVM, but between the BVM and that mask should be a viral filter. And that filter, those are rated for 99.999% viral filtration efficacy, better than anything else you could have, better than your N95 mask. And so if you put that non-invasive mask on your patient with a good seal, put that viral filter on and then attach it to a BVM on high FiO2, then none of the patient's exhalations are getting out to the environment without filtration unless there's a mask leak. And that mask leak is certainly no worse than the leak that's built into a non-rebreather mask. So this is definitely a step up in safety and a marked step up in efficacy of pre-oxygenation. So you're getting two for one. You're getting better pre-ox and you're getting better safety to the team because very little, if any, non-filtered gas is going to be vented into the room. If you can get a PEEP valve, you could put that on as well. Now, the PEEP valve is not going to work great unless there's a nasal cannula underneath that non-invasive mask. Now, the nasal cannula sizes we use do not cause a mask leak and therefore are safe. And I would put that low, 4-6 liters per minute on that nasal cannula. And what that's going to do is fuel your PEEP valve, but none of that unfiltered gas is making it back to that PEEP valve. So the patient is still not venting to the environment, even though you now have the capability of giving them CPAP pre-oxygenation. So this is one option, and you could do this anywhere. You don't need a ventilator. You don't need a machine. So this is something that may be further down in this disaster when we run out of vents. It may be our option for pre-ox. It may be our option for ventilating patients. And so that's a pretty complicated description in words. I just put up a post on MCRIT with pictures and words that will help you understand. But Swami, you must have questions already. What do you think about this first better attempt at pre-oxygenation?
I love the idea. I think that in order for people to do it, they're going to have to actually simulate it and run it beforehand. This isn't something you're going to be able to cobble together in the moment. It's just not going to happen. You're not going to have all the equipment that's there. And my biggest concern for these patients, again, like we mentioned up front, is that they are going to be coming in sometimes with saturations in the low 70s or high 60s, meaning that my intubation attempt is going to be extremely difficult. It's going to be extremely short. I'm only going to have a couple of seconds. And really, there is no safe apneic time when they're that low. I'm assuming, though, that you don't want to keep them awake for this intubation because they're still going to be spewing stuff out into the air around you.
Well, let's be clear here. What I've just described is a pre-oxygenation technique, and you're not squeezing that bag. This is just a way of getting high FAO2 and PEEP, if you need it, to these patients to not leave them at 70% before your intubation in a way that's safe. So you're not squeezing the bag at this point. You're not giving them positive pressure ventilation. They're doing all the work. This is a setup that allows you to pre-ox. The other way you could do it, if you have a ventilator in the room, which you probably are going to need for the post-intubation management anyway, is do exactly what I just described, but use the vent as your pre-ox and just put them on CPAP and pressure support. Between the vent tubing and the patient's non-invasive mask, put that same viral filter. And you will want to, today, get those viral filters in your emergency department because this is how you want to bag these patients as well, and this is how you want to ventilate them. So this is not something that, oh, if I have it, I could think about this. This is something today you want to call respiratory and say, we need a whole bunch of high-efficiency viral filters in the department. But now you can put the patient on CPAP and pressure support, 0/0, 100% FiO2, and now again, the patient is getting high FiO2 pre-oxygenation. You could add in PEEP if you need it without having to have anything vented to the environment aside from what's leaking around the mask of the non-invasive setup. And there should be very little, if any, certainly a dramatic amount less than a non-rebreather mask.
That latter approach might be the one that more people can actually get done. You're using your vent to do non-invasive. You're using the same mask that you use for your non-invasive ventilation. But again, that HEPA filter, that viral filter is really going to be critically important. And you're right. I don't know how many are in my hospital. I don't know if my respiratory therapists who live in my emergency department have those there, or they're only upstairs in the ICU. And so it's going to be a stocking issue, just like it is with all of our PPEs, to make sure it's in the location where it has to be, which is the emergency department, as well as the units.
Absolutely. All right. So you've pre-oxygenated this patient as best you can, and now you're ready to intubate. For me, the only thing that makes sense, you talked about awake intubation before. I don't think that's a great option in these patients. You want this done as quickly and as safely as possible for both you and the patient. And even if they're a difficult airway, I think in most of these patients, it's going to be rapid sequence intubation with a high dose paralytic for me to just get the first pass attempt being the best possible. What about you, Swami?
Yeah, I agree. I think, again, we have to get this done as quickly as possible. We know that we are really good when we do paralytics and induction agents as opposed to doing the awake, and the awake approach takes a little bit more time. Get it done quick. How about the intubation itself? Should I be reaching for video, direct, bougie first? Any modifications to the usual recommendations here?
Well, a couple in my mind. First of all, this is not an intern level intubation, and I don't even know if they need to be in the room. So, you know, minimal staff to get the job done. And that means the person most capable of first pass success should be doing the intubation. Now, in the shops that are doing things right, that's going to be the attending. If for whatever reason, you're at a place where the attendings haven't intubated in 4 years and your fourth year EM resident is the best person in the department, then, you know, consider that. Though I'm really always leery of places where the residents are more skilled than the attendings. We got issues there that need to be dealt with, but not during the COVID crisis. You mentioned video. Yes, I think there's zero reason not to do video, especially because it allows you to keep your face away from the patient's face if you're using devices that have wires as opposed to the ones with the screen built into the handle. So, you know, for me, it's going to be a CMAC or a GlideScope. And then we will be using bougies as long as we're using standard geometry blades. If you're using a hyperangulated blade because that's all you got, then you have to use the stylet built for that blade. And then since you don't want to have to mess around with the tube and deflate the cuff and do all that garbage, you want to get your depth right on the first pass as well, which means almost every endotracheal tube out there has a line telling you if this line's at the cords, your depth is perfect. Actually look for that line as opposed to doing what we normally do, which is stick it in at some random level and then have to keep pulling back in order to get breath sounds back on the left side. And since these patients may have whited out lungs, auscultation's not even really accurate. So I think it really behooves you to, as you intubate, just see the cuff just past the cords, or if you have a line on your ET tube, use that, and then you do not need to auscultate. Just use end tidal to confirm your endotracheal tube.
Once you get that tube in, you hook them up to the vent. You can pop back to our last breaking news segment on how to ventilate these patients, especially if they've already developed acute respiratory distress syndrome. Anything else that we need to be aware about in terms of post-intubation sedation, post-intubation management? What's going to be different, or is it pretty much the same at that point?
Well, you know, Swami, I just want to mention one more thing, if I may, which is if you fail your first intubation attempt and need to reoxygenate these patients, how to do it safely. And I, you know, I'm going to keep, it's like a broken record, but you want to have those viral filters and you want that on the stem of your BVM before you actually intubate. Because if you have to reox, then either a two-hand mask seal with that viral filter or an LMA with that viral filter will be a much safer way to go than allowing the exhalation of that BVM to blow directly into your face. So you have to have these viral filters in your department. And then you want a good mask seal or a good LMA seal. And the way to make that happen is to have end-tidal CO2 between the bag stem and the viral filter. Because now, with each breath you give, if you're getting a wonderful end-tidal CO2 waveform, it means two things. One, you're reoxygenating the patient, and two, you're not venting gas around the patient's mask into your face. Or if you have a good mask seal with the LMA, the same thing. You're minimizing the amount of mask leak or seal leak with either of those devices. So having end-tidal CO2 on your bag, not just for the successful intubation, but for the reoxygenation, I think is critical. Okay, so, you know, you asked about post-intubation management, Swami, and, you know, Haney did a great job on this. It's easy, strict ARDSnet, and then if you're getting up to the higher peeps, call your intensivists and get them involved as if they weren't already involved. But, you know, if you're already at 20 a peep 20 seconds after intubation, you know, that's the time to put out a stat call, because we might need to do things like airway pressure release ventilation or consider ECMO if we still have machines available. The other thing is there either needs to be a viral filter or a clamp tube for any circuit disconnects. So if you're going to disconnect to change to a different ventilator, you should clamp your tube or have a viral filter on top of that tube and not take that off when you change the circuit, because that's going to keep people safe in the environment. If you use suction, it should be a closed circuit suction. There should be no red rubber tube suctioning. That seems like a bad idea. In terms of sedation, I don't know if I'm going to do anything different. I'd have to really think through the plus and minuses. At this stage, we're doing everything exactly the same. The last thing I'd mention as a miscellaneous item is, let's say you have a low-risk asthmatic come in with bronchospasm. They have no other risk factors aside from the environment we're in for COVID. They're not febrile. They don't have a pneumonia. The question I'd ask to you, Swami, and then I'll give you my answer, would be, are you going to give NEBS to these patients?
That's a really tricky one. We have a lot of patients who have bronchospasm. Obviously, they can still get this. And we need to give them NEBS to open them up, but maybe there are other options. Before the inhaled beta agonist, we did have epi, sub-Q epi, IM epi was used for asthmatics as well as COPDers. So if we have a high suspicion for COVID, then maybe that's the better approach, because those NEBS is just going to be spewing stuff into the environment around you.
Yeah, so I have a solution for that too. And I don't think this is a solution for that high-risk COVID patient. You know, they come in febrile and coughing up phlegm, and then you get your x-ray and it's, you know, multilobar pneumonia. But for the lower risk patients, if you take that same unvented non-invasive mask, attach that to your nebulizer, and then on the exhalation port of the nebulizer, put yet another viral filter, This is now a closed system that gets filtration before anything goes in the environment. I would still prefer to have that patient in a negative pressure room for their nebulizer treatment, but this is a system, and you can see it on mcrit.org, that will allow you to nebulize with no exposure to the environment aside from what leaks out of a bad mask seal on the non-invasive mask.
Yeah, and Scott, in case we didn't say it before, these patients, if you're doing an invasive procedure like this, obviously should be in a negative pressure isolation room, because that gives us the highest level of protection that we possibly can of taking that air that's in the room, that all of that stuff that's being spewed out and filtering it out. This is not a place to use a general resuscitation room. You really do want that negative pressure room for these.
All right. Now, Swami, you asked me when we were prepping for this episode about what happens after they're intubated in terms of staff safety. Should we do that now?
I think this is really important, Scott. So I've intubated the patient. I have them in that negative isolation room. I've done all of this PPE. I've got the N95 on. I've got a hood on. I've got the face shield. I've got the bunny suit. Now that I've intubated them, I'm on a closed respiratory circuit. Do I still need the same level of isolation? Can I take them out of that negative pressure ISO? Do I still need the higher level of PPE, or is a surgical mask enough?
All right, so no one really has answers to these questions, so I'm going to give you my best opinion as I've been doing. The first thing I should say is, just as I mentioned, there's two kinds of non-invasive machines. There's two kinds of ventilators, and there are some crappy ventilators out there with only one tube in which the patient is exhaling to the environment. Those should not be used in this situation, in my opinion, unless we run out of all other ventilators. And then those patients need to be in a negative pressure room, but the problem is when we run out of the good ventilators, we probably have run out of negative pressure rooms as well. But that seems a situation just avoidable by any means possible, to have each exhalation of a patient on a ventilator going to the environment, unless you have a viral filter between that tube and the patient's ET tube, which is possible in many systems. I haven't tested all. Ours certainly could put a viral filter on the ET and then the vent, and then those ventilators may be okay, because even though they're exhaling to the environment, they're still exhaling through a viral filter. But let's say you have a good tube ventilator, so they're exhaling to a closed system. You have a viral guard on the ET, and you have a viral guard on the exhalation port of your vent. Well, now this is a safer circumstance, but just because we know there's the possibility of inadvertent ventilator disconnects, I would still prefer to wear an N95 mask on any patient who's confirmed or highly suspected of COVID. Though, I do feel better about walking into that room, because chances are very good that nothing's being exhale to the environment. Now, do I need to go on full, hot zone level precautions like we did for the intubation itself? No, probably not. I think just a disposable surgical gown, the N95 mask, and some form of eye protection, you're pretty much good to go.
Scott, thanks so much for discussing all this with us. Anything that you want to add, or have you addressed everything that you want to in terms of managing these patients' airways?
The only thing I'll add is MCRIT will continue to update that post. That's the way we do it on MCRIT, is if I find new information or something wrong or better ideas, that post keeps getting iteratively updated. So keep checking back. And Farkas also has a very good resource on all things COVID that's continuously updated in his internet book of critical care.
Fantastic. And of course, we will drop all the links in the show notes to those posts, and we will have as much information as we can as we get it. We will get it back out to you. If we learn new things about intubation and the personal protection equipment or the approach, we will do another update with Scott in the future. Scott, thanks so much.
Swami, always a pleasure, brother. Stay safe.